The peasants' revolt was over. For a few days, the overriding concern of the politics of the City of London had been forced to take a back seat as national events had literally fallen upon its streets in a campaign of bloodshed, fire, and death. But now it was over. And guess what? London's politics are about to take centre stage again, real fast, only this time, well, there's going to be an armed uprising, hundreds are going to take to the streets, buildings are going to be attempted to be torn down, and people are going to end up dead on Cheapside. Yep, that's correct. Within 3 years of the well-known carnage of the Peasants' Revolt, a completely overlooked second eruption of chaos and violence broke out on London streets. Get ready, because the great saga of the era of the Jubilee was about to take more twists than a corkscrew. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell a chronological account of the history of the City of London, presenting the tale in the form of a grand narrative. We are moving to look at what happened in London in the years following the Peasants' Revolt, and, well, the wild twists and turns we meet along the way. Welcome, then, to Chapter 135 of The Story of London, The Terrible Revenge of John de Northampton. The Peasants' Revolt was dead. While the revolt had spread across the country, while groups of rebels were active in parts of East Anglia, Hertfordshire, Yorkshire and elsewhere, while Cambridge suffered just as much as London did, the truth is, once the news of the events in London began to filter its way across England, the steam went out of the entire movement. There were a few more weeks of trouble, but by the end of July, almost every part of England was now under the control of the state. The national political backlash to those wild events was instant and, at first, all-consuming. With the imminent crisis over, the King's Council turned to restoring order in the realm. They actually started the very day of Wat Tyler's death. An ad hoc commission was created, led by the likes of Knowles, Walworth and Brembe, and two other Londoners. Their job was to do whatever was required to restore order in London and to prevent further disturbances. Another commission was granted to the same men in association with one of the Chief Justices, Belknap, to initiate judicial proceedings against all the rebels. Starting in London and rippling outwards, more commissions were issued over the next few days. On the 18th of June, letters were sent to the sheriffs ordering them to proclaim the enforcement of the peace and to take whatever measures were necessary to crush the rebels. By the 20th, the powers of a similar sort had been given to the Earl of Buckingham and Chief Justice Trelasyon throughout England, and to the Constable of Dover and the Sheriff of Hampshire. By the 23rd of June, commissions granting military and judicial powers were issued to the leading gentry in most of the counties of southern England. The full weight of the law of the English state was being brought down on any who had dared to rebel. In London, Mayor Woolworth executed a number of leading rebels, seeking out those who had had a hand in events like murdering Archbishop Sudbury. And yet, paradoxically, across England, only Bishop Despenser of Norwich, who was active in suppressing the rebellion over in Norfolk, appears to have followed the mayor's example. Because the truth is, mostly all those people involved in the Great Revolt, they were pardoned. Now, according to at least one historian I've read, part of the reason for this could have been down simply to the law codes of the 14th century. The Statute of Treasons of 1352, you see, had defined treason in deliberately narrow terms and had not made specific reference to popular insurrection. According to that statute, if you went for the king or his family, that was treason. But only that. In the aftermath of the revolt, the young king and his advisors had been trying to encourage the local judges to see anyone involved as traitors, at least to judge them in terms of the commissions it issued. But it turns out that outside of Norfolk and London, other commission holders did not share those views. In many cases, they preferred to define these offences not as treason, but as a felony. And as a result, many of the most prominent rebels escaped lightly. Within London, the goldsmith Thomas Farringdon, aldermans Horne and Sibilly. Others, they got away with periods of imprisonment or fines or even just obtained straight pardons. Only one county offered active resistance to these new edicts, and that was Essex. Richard II had to make a personal visit to Essex to oversee the pacification of the county. He left the capital on the 22nd of June with a sizeable force, and the following day he reached Waltham. Here he was met by a deputation of Essex rebels. The same men, really, he had met a few weeks earlier at Mile End. And they immediately started demanding of the king that he should honour the promises he made to them at that meeting, which we covered last episode. Now reinforced with enough armed men to not take this shit, the young king supposedly exploded in indignation at this last bastion of the Great Rebellion. Quote, "You wretches, detestable on land and sea, you who seek equality with lords are unworthy to live. Give this message to your colleagues. Rustics you were, and rustics you are still, and you will remain in bondage, not as before, but incomparably harsher. For as long as we live, we will strive to suppress you, and your misery will be an example in the eyes of posterity. However, we will spare your lives if you remain faithful," unquote. The young boy was coming into his own, or seemed to be, and the royal government was stronger. And for London, one of the side effects was this, that he showed for Nicholas Brembe a respect and friendship which commanded in return a loyalty from the merchant back to him. It was a most unusual friendship. Perhaps the seeds of this strange relationship were sown in the dark hours in the royal wardrobe, when the 14-year-old boy was left to contemplate the possibility of losing his crown and kingdom, and his life even, and was obliged to trust his security to the merchants of London, the same men whom his royal uncles despised and hated. But to add to the complexity of this moment, we have to take on board that right now, in the aftermath of the Great Revolt, the focus of all of London's political capital was upon this king and his uncle. The ongoing issues between Brembe, Mayor Woolworth, and all the rest who are at odds with John of Gaunt and his brothers, we covered back in chapter 132, and these now became crucial again. John of Gaunt was still alive, and that changed all political considerations. Indeed, over the next few months, this shadow was to dominate everything in London's politics, and the game was about to become much more intriguing. Before the revolt, John of Gaunt had ridden out of the Savoy on the 12th of May on his way northwards to negotiate with the Marcher Lords in the north. This would be the last time he ever saw his beloved palace. John of Gaunt reached Knaresborough when the rebels were marching on London, but the hatred towards him followed him up north and was exploited, perhaps, by his enemies amongst the nobility, most of all by Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland. Whatever actually happened, the two men developed a sudden and intense feud. The cause does seem to have been a misunderstanding that took place in the north between messengers between them both. It's a complicated and confusing sequence of events and accusations, a huge ado about little. And the real conflict really emerged because both men were proud and neither were in the mood to back down towards the other. But this row between the Duke of Lancaster and the Earl of Northumberland very soon became a overwhelming political conflict. Matters came to a head at a session of the Royal Council on the 15th of August in Westminster. In spite of the Earl's repeated apologies for any misunderstandings, John of Gaunt alleged that Northumberland had not only denied him access to provisions when he was in the north, but had also spread rumours that he was willing to give over his young nephew and join sides with the Scots. Northumberland responded very angrily to this. Gauntlets were thrown down. Intervention from the other councillors prevented the two men from just breaking into a fight there and then. But this was merely a temporary halt to a serious personality clash. At the next council session, on the 9th of October in Berkhamsted, John of Gaunt repeated his allegations, and the Earl responded with a verbal torrent of abuse. And so the following November, when the first Parliament since the Peasants' Revolt was due to meet, supposedly to talk about the Peasants' Revolt, the clash between the two men was actually the principal thing on everybody's agenda. Rumours were abounding of impending violence between the retinues of these two northern landowners. Apparently, the Londoners exploited the dispute as a vehicle for their own hatred of the Duke of Lancaster, and made their sympathies clear in a rapturous welcome for the Earl of Northumberland. John of Gaunt was the king's oldest surviving uncle. He was a power upon the land, and a mob of Londoners had attacked and systematically destroyed his home in London. Whatever happened, the city knew they were going to be in the crosshairs of his rage. John of Gaunt arrived with a large retinue in his attendance, and he lodged at the Bishop of London's manor in Fulham. And the citizens of London, who had good reason to fear what Gaunt might do in retaliation for the sack of the Savoy, enrolled the Earl of Northumberland as a citizen and allowed him to take up residence in the city along with his troops from the Scottish border, just in case. Tensions were that high. The merchants of London, the aldermen of London, the heroes of the Peasants' Revolt were immediately afterwards picking a side, fearful of their future and looking for any kind of solution. And it is in this climate that dramatically their main rival within London, John de Northampton, suddenly reappears in our story. John de Northampton, who we really spoke about back in chapters 131 and 132, played no recorded part in the revolt in London. Probably he took care to lie low, because anyone with a close connection to John of Gaunt was in danger from those mobs. Northampton's closest supporter, a man called John Moore, was bound over at the end of July 1381 with 12 others to keep the peace. But that seems more like he was belatedly trying to make capital out of the Peasants' Revolt. There is simply no evidence to suggest that Northampton or any of his faction were in any position to exploit the Peasants' Revolt to regain political power. Indeed, in the months after the revolt, the Staplers faction were utterly unchallenged, dominating London's politics. And in fact, we see that Philpot and three grocers, Hadley, Barrett and Falstaff, were elected to be the city's MPs in that Parliament of September 1381. But the Staplers were smart men. They were worried not just about John of Gaunt's attitude towards London, but also his ability to influence government policy over the next few years, potentially against their interest. Now the madness of the Peasants' Revolt was over. These underlying issues, which had haunted London for years, now returned to the fore. In Flanders, the revolt of the craftsmen had developed into a civil war, which was to last for several years. London grocers were losing cargoes to pirates involved in the fighting there, and this had utterly depressed the Flemish market. On top of this, the sudden increase in Italian exports of wool and cloth from Southampton threatened not only the grocers, but all of London's mercers and drapers. Their growing wealth depended on cloth exports being funneled through London. This combination of issues drew together the exporting merchants from many crafts guilds. What had divided them had been the issues of the Calais staple, but even the grocers were now finding that it ceased to operate in their favour. The old rivalries between London's factions were again having to be put to one side in the need to unite. The reduced demand for wool overseas led the grocers for the first time to take a serious interest in cloth exports, which drew them closer to the drapers and the mercers. And it was for this reason that suddenly, and out of the blue, the aldermen of London decided to elect John de Northampton as Mayor of London in October 1381. For the residents of London, this is merely being driven by the real politique of the moment. If John of Gaunt was to become the dominant political figure in England, more dominant than he'd been in the past, then the only one certain way the leading alderman knew of conciliating with him was to appoint as mayor his protege, John de Northampton. He had been known as the Duke's ally since 1377, and the strength of that continuing relationship being exhibited by the Duke of Lancaster pardoning Northampton's henchman, Robert Francis, for homicide in November 1378. Although Northampton held no prominent civic office since the Gloucester Parliament of that year, he had been elected a common councillor in 1380, and some of his followers had continued to stir up trouble in the city by supporting tailors or other cloth workers in a campaign of accusations brought in the city courts against the clergy and foreigners, including Flemish weavers. Flemish weavers, many of whom had been murdered on the streets of London. That massacre of the Flemish weavers and the prominent part taken by the cloth workers in the Great Revolt show the fruitfulness of this kind of agitation, which John Moore was probably trying to exploit even after the revolt had suppressed, and that's why he was bound over afterwards. Anyway, electing John de Northampton as mayor on the 13th of October 1381 seemed to be the best hope for preventing any renewed agitation from these outsiders in London's politics and of protecting the city's interests against the resurgent and vengeful Duke of Lancaster. The fact that Northampton was not even an alderman when he was elected emphasises the special measures taken behind choosing him. And thus, with their new compliant mayor, we get to that parliament. London was worried that even electing de Northampton would not be enough. They made plans. In case the Duke of Lancaster should become more militant, the city also began strengthening its defences. As the meeting of Parliament approached, London became more like an armed camp, prepared to defend its independence, hence why they had welcomed the Earl of Northumberland and his Scottish borderer troops. The Duke of Lancaster, however, played it cool. He had seemingly learned from events in 1377. And as we said, he quartered his men near Fulham. With Northampton as mayor, he could feel confident that he had all the influence he needed within the city walls. The strategy seemingly paid off. And as for his row with the Earl of Northumberland, well, after allowing both men to have their say, young King Richard intervened. This was a considerable challenge, with the eyes of Parliament upon him, he had to satisfy the honour of two great men who had exchanged very angry words. Somehow, a compromise was found. John of Gaunt's ego was salved by Northampton's apology, which was delivered on bended knee, during which he said, quote, "And also to you, my lord, who are the greatest lord and the highest person of the realm after my liege lord the king, here present, and I, of your blood and alliance, having thrown down my gage before you in the presence of my liege lord the king here present, I beg your pardon, an honourable lordship," unquote. The Earl and the Duke were then publicly reconciled and exchanged a kiss of peace. But while the issue was solved, the Grant-Percy dispute revealed the extent to which the uprising had been capable of exasperating ever-present but usually invisible tensions between these men. These kind of tensions were under the surface, and they'd show up an awful lot in the years to come. The meeting of the Parliament did confirm the Duke of Lancaster's ascendancy over the royal government, and Lancaster installed his own follower, Sir Richard Scope, as Chancellor. He also established himself as head of a commission appointed by Parliament to reform the royal administration, the shortcomings of which were held responsible for the peasants' revolt. The country saw all of this and breathed a sigh of relief, and everything seemed to calm down. The initial months of John de Northampton's term as mayor witnessed a reduction, a significant one, of tensions within the city. The Stapler faction saw John de Northampton's election as a politically expedient solution to the threat posed by John of Gaunt, and initially, John de Northampton demonstrated a willingness to maintain cordial relations with the individuals who had elected him. The new mayor's primary objective was to secure the necessary funds for his patron. In January 1382, the Duke addressed Parliament, requesting a loan of £100,000, which he proposed to use as half a year's wages for the army he intended to raise. He presented his plans as part of a new strategy aimed at attacking France from its southern direction. His plan was to pursue his own personal claim to the throne of Castilla, which was based on the right of his wife, and additionally his brother sought the throne of Portugal, which was based on the right of his wife. However, the Parliament thought the idea an entirely huge waste of cash, which meant that if John of Gaunt wanted to go for the throne of Castilla, he needed the cash from somewhere else. He turned his eyes towards the merchants of London. They, though, were very averse to any expenditure which diverted cash from the protection of the Anglo-Flemish trade on the Channel, and they were also rightfully afraid of Gaunt's power. He knew it would not be an easy request to get cash from them, and his main hope lay in the fact that John de Northampton was mayor and he'd bring pressure upon the city to lend him the money. John de Northampton was now immediately faced with a dilemma. Only the staplers and grocers and rich merchants of London had the necessary funds to supply his patron, but only with their compliance could he restore to positions of influence the men who had been his trusted followers in the earlier part of his political career. Unless he could remove the ban on their election to office, he could not rebuild his political strength. Northampton decided to get his supporters back before he was going to ask for money. He likely offered the staplers incentives to lift the ban on his followers. What kind of incentives? Well, one was a measure he announced to safeguard the fishmongers and grocers trade. Specifically, he stipulated that all powdered drugs should be only sold by the pound of 15 ounces, rather than the 12-ounce pound commonly used by the goldsmiths and merchants for selling silk. This regulation sounds weird, but it effectively reinforced the grocers' domination over the trade of the apothecaries. As a result, on the 13th of February, 1382, the five long-term followers of John de Northampton, who included the draper William Essex and the mercers John Moore and Robert Norbury, who we met back in chapter 130, were declared to now be of, quote, loyal and good behaviour in all things towards the city and not suspects, unquote. And they were again allowed to exercise any office to which they were elected. These men from the last decade were now all back. And amongst the aldermen who approved their reinstatement were the grocers Adam Carlyle and John Churchman and the fishmongers Horn and Sibilly. John de Northampton himself was elected alderman for Dowgate in March, and John Moore as alderman for Cordwainder. Three other followers of Northampton, Thomas Charlton, a rich borderer, Henry Begg, a draper, and Adam Bam, a goldsmith, were elected aldermen with him. In this way, Northampton was able to regroup his faction with the aid of his former opponents under the flag of London United. Nevertheless, the representation of his faction on the Governing Council of London was small, and it was incapable of defeating the staplers if it came down to it. John de Northampton was well aware that a chance of keeping this power he enjoyed as mayor rested on the staplers continuing to believe in the influence he enjoyed over the Duke of Lancaster. But now that influence in turn depended entirely on his ability to raise money for the Duke. A Grand Council was convened in February 1382, inviting merchants from London and major towns to discuss the loan to the Duke of Lancaster for his proposed invasion. However, they declined to provide loans to the Crown. Consequently, Parliament was summoned in May 1382, and a request was given for £60,000 for an expedition to be led by the King himself against the French, that just so happened to be identical to his uncle's. The Knights of the Shire insisted that only merchants could advise on raising such a substantial sum. A committee of 14 was formed to discuss the matter. Seven of them were Londoners: Hadley, Brembe, Venor, Fastoff, and the grocer Philpot. And the result? They expressed concern about lending the requested amount, considering the feint of merchants who had lent similar sums to Edward III. Their refusal to provide the money meant that Parliament was dismissed, with only a modest increase in customs granted to the King, and even this increase was stipulated to be used only for safeguarding the seas. This blatant refusal of a loan to John of Gaunt, not once but twice, by the leading grocers and their fellow merchants of London, ended any possibility of peaceful relations with the Duke of Lancaster. On the 31st of May that year, the Italian Matthew Cheney made a huge loan to the Exchequer, and it was declared that anyone who would pay the increased customs dues in advance to the Exchequer might export wool whenever he chose in the following year. There could be no clearer signal to the staplers that a failure to pay what the Crown demanded would deprive them of all benefits of the staple and would lead to increased favour for foreign merchants. Brembe and his fellow grocers must have expected such an outcome. What they wouldn't have counted upon was John de Northampton learning from his past. Brembe and Woolworth and the staplers had gained their political ascendancy by backstabbing John de Northampton back in 1376 and 1378. He knew he had to strike first this time. Northampton had proved himself in 1376 a master of political tactics, but it's doubtful if even his old associates amongst the grocers could have foreseen the skill in which he first divided and then set about destroying the stapler political faction. The grocers, who were represented by only three aldermen at the time, were at first left alone. Northampton's target was the fishmongers, who held six aldermanries and were the more easily attacked because they controlled one of the staple foods of the city, and they could be accused of profiteering at the expense of the poor. The distress endured by the eastern fishing ports and the French attacks on the Thames estuary had inevitably affected the supply of fish to London and its price. Consequently, it was easy to accuse the fishmongers of artificially raising prices. Northampton's policy of exploiting popular grievances like this had already borne fruit that year. Earlier that year, he had seized on the issues of ecclesiastical fees. This had a double merit of attracting popular support in London while earning Lancaster's approval, because he was attacking those clergy who were attacking John Wycliffe. Northampton continued to encourage harassment of the clergy, abetted by William Essex, and he succeeded in removing from ecclesiastical courts jurisdiction over offences such as adultery and immorality, which now came under the jurisdiction of the Mayor's Court. Flushed with this success, John de Northampton now waged a new populist campaign against the fishmongers, who he now claimed were blackmailing the city by keeping the price of fish artificially high. This sudden attack took the staplers entirely by surprise and was a genuine threat upon their majority in the Court of the Aldermen. At the end of June, the Mayor, Aldermen and the Common Council issued a series of proclamations which brought the fishmongers' retail monopoly to an end by forbidding them to buy fish from importers for resale in the city until it had first been exposed for sale to the public for at least 3 days. The fishmongers retaliated by buying up supplies of fish before they reached the city and selling them outside the walls. This was just what he needed, and John de Northampton established complete freedom of trade in fish for everyone, a free citizen or an unfree citizen within the City of London. He followed this up on August 1st with a brilliantly timed campaign against individual leading fishmongers, whose baskets were inspected and condemned for giving short measure. Very cunningly, the mayor had summoned 46 prominent merchants to examine the fishmongers' baskets, of whom 10 of which were grocers. By doing this, the grocers could not avoid being drawn into condemning their stapler allies. The Common Council was used, as it had been in 1376, to propose all these measures, and it seems clear that it was dominated again by Northampton's old allies, William Essex and his other associates such as Richard Norbury. Mayor Northampton was now using it again to pick off his enemies one by one in the Court of Aldermen. And now he went after the leading individuals. The first to be attacked was the fishmonger, Nicholas Exton. Exton, who we've followed over several chapters now. If you can remember, we first encountered him. He was one of the fishmongers who was involved in an attack upon a fellow fishmonger in Southwark. And then he went on to become an MP. Exton was one of the fishmonger's strongest voices, and it was his voice that got him into trouble. John de Northampton targeted him for using, quote, opprobrious words, unquote, against the mayor. Exton the Firebrand was trapped as the mayor used the rules against him, and he gave in without a struggle. On the 16th of August, the next victim was the grocer Adam Carlyle. He was debarred from all public office for attacking the measures taken against the fishmongers. The grocers lost in Carlyle one of their boldest and most outspoken leaders. These measures taken against Exton and Carlyle quickly silenced all opposition. When the writ of the 9th of August arrived ordering the election of four members of Parliament, the four chosen were all close supporters of John de Northampton. Moore and Carlton were chosen by the aldermen, Essex and Norbury by the commonalty. Intimidation alone could not have produced such a unanimous vote of support for Mayor de Northampton, and he simply used the tools Nicholas Brembe had used against him, now back against Brembe and his supporters. Anyone who voiced dissatisfaction could be informed on and imprisoned, as a hostel had found out that much. The Common Council was packed with Northampton supporters, and plans were laid and orders given through the secret meetings of an inner group which met at Goldsmith Hall, no doubt under the aegis of Nicholas Tyford. Northampton was riding a wave of popularity due to his measures to reduce the price of fish and also reducing ecclesiastical fees. Quote, the people were eating out of his hand whatever he tried to do, unquote. Immediately before the upcoming mayoral election in October, he issued another set of proclamations, this time on the subject of brokers, the hated middleman position and business dealings often dominated by foreigners. This was designed to increase his popularity with the drapers and the mercers. There were to be a maximum of four brokers for each guild, and all of them had to be elected by the guilds. Rules were laid down controlling their activities, and penalties of imprisonment and the pillory were to be used for false and usurious bargains. The trade guilds could feel, as a result of these ordinances, that John de Northampton was doing his utmost to protect them from foreign competition. But even his rivals could see the benefits and wisdom in this move. I mean, let's be straight here. The grocers, his biggest rivals, were the first profession to swear in new brokers before the mayor. Yet while Mayor de Northampton was on a roll, the sheer political heft of the ruling faction was so great that despite the massive popularity which Northampton earned by these measures, he's doubtful he would have secured all four MPs for his supporters and his own re-election as mayor without some additional ammunition, which came in open support from the Crown in the person of the Duke of Lancaster. The King's letter on the 7th of October advising the aldermen and the commonalty to re-elect John de Northampton was essential to the stage management of his victory. The Crown's position had even convinced Philpot, John Hadley and Adam de Changer de St. Ives, who'd helped elect Northampton, that his special relation with Lancaster and through him to the Crown would secure for them the favour they needed if the city was to recover its privileges and prosperity. All his rivals seemed to blink at this moment as John de Northampton unleashed this devastating political attack. All that is, bar one. Nicholas Brembe did not vote for Northampton. The two men were opposites, one man's yin to another man's yang. Be it ideologically or personally, the gulf between them was too vast. Brembe would never accept Northampton leading him. He sought to change the narrative and regain the political momentum. And this led to him giving the king the first loan from a Londoner for 2 years. But it was too little and too late. John de Northampton was now ready to strike. 16 months after Brembe and Mayor Woolworth and the Aldermen of London had emerged from the Peasants' Revolt on a high, the new Mayor of London was now determined to destroy their political power. And the battlefield was to be the Parliament, which met in October 1382. John de Northampton knew from his own experiences as a Member of Parliament in 1378 how the Knights of the Shire were always ready to blame the town guilds for any rise in the prices or shortages of food. It was an easy matter, therefore, to get the support of Parliament for a petition he presented through his followers against the London fishmongers' exercise of their trade. It was concluded with a request for what had been his aim all along, the exclusion of his political opponents from office. The exclusion was directed not only against the fishmongers, but all victuallers, a class which could be interpreted as including the vintners, the butchers, the apothecaries, and of course, the grocers. Northampton also included in the petition requests which were intended to make his opponent's exclusion from power permanent. It asked that all subsequent mayors should take an oath at the Exchequer to uphold the measures against the fishmongers and against usurers. Parliament and the Crown would, John de Northampton hoped, confirm and make permanent the political ascendancy which he had already won in the city. London's fishmongers defended themselves stoutly in Parliament against these measures. Exon said that far from being a device for the common good profit of the kingdom, they were the fruit of hatred, rancor, and envy. Alderman Sibyl claimed that Northampton's enmity towards them dated back to 1371, when Woolworth, as sheriff, had been responsible for carrying out the king's orders and imprisoning John de Northampton. It was probably to silence their opposition that Northampton's ally, John Moore, accused Sibylle Horne and Carlyle of treachery in opening the city gates to the rebels. If you remember a few chapters ago when I was describing these accusations and I said they were made for political purposes, this is the political purpose. Tensions were ratcheting up in London. Down the road in Westminster, Exton declared at one point to the assembled members of Parliament that if he'd been home the previous night, he would have been arrested on the mayor's orders and led through the middle of Cheap like a robber or a cutpurse. And the sudden disappearance of John Philpot, Brembe's brother-in-law, from office at this crucial juncture suggests that Exton's claim may not have been exaggerated. Philpot was a bit of a hero. He was known as, quote, a friend of those the mayor was jealous of, unquote. And it seems that John Moore orchestrated the Common Council to accuse Philpot of withholding 2,000 francs entrusted to him by two Italians. Little doubt the whole thing was engineered to deprive Philpot of his office. The case was presented before the mayor on September the 19th, and the outcome of the case is not reported, but really the outcome was not important. What was needed was Philpot to be removed, another one of his crucial enemies removed. John de Northampton's tactics once again drew parallels to his successful strategies in 1376. He had diminished and removed all his opponents. He was Lord of London. Now is time to play his masterstroke. A petition was presented in Parliament for the restoration of London's franchises and free customs, despite existing statutes to the contrary. This petition gave London everything it hoped for when they saw the re-election of Northampton as mayor. The royal assent to the petition granted the city's franchise and liberties as had been under the king's progenitors, restoring what had been lost in 1378. In the eyes of all the London guilds, John de Northampton was redeemed. However, this victory was bitter for the fishmongers and the grocers. The grant was contingent upon victuallers not enjoying any charters or liberties and being entirely subject to the mayor of London's government. This was a triumph for John de Northampton, and its effects were almost immediate. The fishmongers were swiftly reduced to a dire situation. Further harassment of their trade nearly threatened to destroy their livelihoods entirely. Former Mayor Woolworth, the hero of King Richard's meeting with Wat Tyler, who had been the only one to bravely oppose the situation, was stripped of his citizenship in November at a meeting of the Court of Aldermen. He was accused of slandering the city in Parliament. Some of the aldermen attempted to defend him, but Northampton threatened to take the case to the king and his council. Exton, who was present, understood that if this escalated, the consequences could have been more severe for him and his allies, and he reluctantly agreed to accept the expulsion. The threat of further royal intervention, placing themselves at the possible mercy of John of Gaunt, seemed to have silenced all the dissenting aldermen. At the meeting, Mayor Woolworth, the great hero of the hour of the peasants' revolt, was now no longer a Londoner. At the meeting of the subsequent Common Council in January, a motion was passed that all sheriffs and aldermen were obliged to take an oath to uphold the ordinances governing the sale and purchase of fish and those governing brokers and false contracts. Apparently, the grocers did nothing to defend either the fishmongers or Philpot and Carlyle. Brembe, the only one of their aldermen who had opposed Northampton's re-election, was the only one who'd stood up for them. The grocers' failure to support their two fellow staplers can be partly attributed to Northampton's skillful political manoeuvring. However, it is undeniable that the grocers were most motivated by the realisation that the future of the staple depended on the Duke of Lancaster, whom they had alienated by refusing the loans. Money was the only way to regain royal favour. And even before John de Northampton launched his campaign to impoverish the fishmongers, it became evident that they were losing their financial and commercial dominance. However, the grocers then began to reorganise themselves under the leadership of Nicholas Brembe. One example, six men were elected by the Common Council to handle cases involving false contracts and brokerage. Four of them were Northampton's close supporters, Moore, Essex, Charlton and Norbury. but the other two were grocers, William Wandsworth and Geoffrey Chelmford. The following month, Moore, Norbury and Essex were re-elected to represent London in the new Parliament, but this time, the fourth MP was Nicholas Brembe. In March 1382, the new election of aldermen produced six grocers, but no fishmongers, as they'd been barred from office. Their places were largely taken by the mercers. For all his success and popularity, John de Northampton had never managed to secure the majority in the court of aldermen. Instead, he'd just intimidated them with the threat of royal intervention. All the measures aimed at removing the staplers from power had been initiated by the Common Council. Northampton skillfully organised the lesser crafts, instructing them how to vote at private meetings directed by his henchmen, 16 of whom were prominent enough to have held the position of warden of their guilds. This political strategy persisted. As long as Northampton could secure the acquiescence of those greater livery companies that weren't dependent on or opposed to the overseas wool staple. Initially, he had promised them the recovery of the franchise. However, the moment he got it, the merchant class quickly resented the power granted to men of the lesser crafts, and they wanted the old status quo of them being in power restored. Their problem, John de Northampton held all the cards, and their allies, the fishmongers, had been destroyed. The grocers could do little by themselves to defeat him. They needed new allies to take the place of the fallen fishmongers of London, allies who would help them buy back royal favour and secure their overseas bloody wool staple. And events in Flanders provided them with exactly what they most wished for. The French invasion of West Flanders in the autumn of 1382 completely halted the wool trade. The Flemings couldn't visit Calais, so the town lost its entire purpose to the political discourse. In December, an English embassy approached the Duke of Holland and Zeeland to discuss relocating the wool staple to his territory. Consequently, English merchants started transporting wool to Middleburg in the spring of 1382. These events coincided with the resurgence of the grocers' influence, facilitated by a new alliance with the mercers. The formal recognition of the moving of the wool staple to Middleburg by the Crown occurred in January 1384. However, for the year prior to that, English merchants had already been using the port instead of Calais as a primary hub for the wool trade. Addition. On top of this, the Italians, Spanish and Portuguese had also relocated to Middleburg due to the war in Flanders rendering it impractical for them to continue their trading in Bruges. This shift allowed the grocers to re-establish their lucrative two-way trade, exporting wool to Middleburg and importing in return the dyes and mordants that were in incredibly high demand by the English cloth industry. Because of this, the English cloth industry experienced a remarkable growth in its exports. And this expansion was also due to the impact of the Civil War in Flanders. The production of Flemish cloth suddenly dropped. Recognising the opportunity, English manufacturers and exporters seized it, capitalising on a sudden gap in the European market. Notably, English cloth, which had been prohibited from being sold in Flemish markets, was now being welcomed in Holland. As a result, cloth exports experienced a huge surge. Some mercers had always been wool exporters, but unlike the grocers, they'd been unable to fully benefit from the double trade from Calais or Bruges because of foreign competition. As we said in previous chapters, the Italians dominated the trade in silks, velvets and other luxury fabrics. They'd consistently imported them to London themselves and sold on directly, leaving the mercers with only limited profit chances, hence why there was great enmity towards the Italians from the mercers. But they now suddenly found themselves being in a position to generate huge amounts of coin, and they liked it. And one can only imagine the grocers quietly smiling and saying to them, "You think this is profitable? Let me tell you how much money you could make if we established a formal wool staple, old chap." From being the plucky underdogs locked out of the great profits being made by the other guilds, and therefore natural supporters of John de Northampton, the mercers of London suddenly saw a chance to break into the big leagues by forming an alliance with Brembe and the grocers. The changed political conditions in Europe had made possible a new alliance between the mercers and the grocers, in London to try to promote an overseas staple. Both these two groups now had loads of disposable capital, and you saw that in the elections of the aldermen in the spring of 1383, which saw a court dominated by 6 grocers and 7 mercers. The sudden influx of cash from their booming trade returned to them their principal weapon. They could now buy the Crown's support for the official recognition of the staple in Middleborough. But while John Doe Northampton was mayor and was maintaining the Common Council against them, neither the grocers nor the mercers could rely on any consistent royal policy. The alderman Philpot took the first step towards separating the Crown from supporting John Doe Northampton by financial help he gave to the ill-fated expedition led by the Bishop of Norwich against the French in May 1383. Shortly afterwards, the Grocer Company elected as its wardens 2 aldermen, John Hadley and John Churchman, in an unprecedented display of the company's political authority. Hadley was second only to Brembe on the list of the company statements of this period, and Churchman had first been elected an alderman in 1381, but his mercantile experience went back to the 1360s. The acceptance by such senior men to the office of warden of the grocers shows that internally Brembe was preparing to strike back at Northampton. He was bringing in some big heavyweight spenders. Their election was followed in September by a large loan to the Crown from the city. 2 grocers were responsible for supervising its payment. The grocers of London were now back in the business of being the financiers of the Crown. They were trying to remove Crown support from John de Northampton. Northampton, though, was far from surrendering power gracefully. The same month, he nominated his lieutenant, John Moore, and another sympathiser as sheriffs. Thus strengthened, he prepared for the coming election, in which he hoped to be chosen for mayor for a 3rd year. His opponent, however, was Nicholas Brembe. The battle lines were drawn. The election was fiercely contested, but the outcome was determined by the absence of royal letters of favour for John de Northampton. Instead, the Crown's influence was utilised to support Nicholas Brembe. John de Northampton's problem was now he'd served the Crown's purpose in forcing the staplers to lend them money. Technically, he could be discarded. Adding to this was the simple fact that the young king wanted to free himself from the influence of his uncle, the Duke of Lancaster. The election was held, and Nicholas Brembe won. Nicholas Brembe was mayor again, and the sudden revenge of John de Northampton was cut short. But these two men were not even close to finishing this particular little spat between them both. And for that, I'm going to cover that next episode, as we carry on with the complex story of the Jubilee. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week for another episode of The Story of London.